Please note that all information and content on UK Health Radio and our blog are provided by the authors, producers, and companies themselves and is only intended as additional information to your general knowledge and does not substitute professional medical advice or treatment. So please do not delay or disregard any medical advice received due to information gathered on the UK Health Radio.
UK Health Radio, real feel-good radio.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the founders, CEOs, clinicians, journalists, politicians that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners and viewers know, I am a CEO and a co-founder of a health tech business myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc's Healthy Heart Check is now the number one tool that's being used outside of a GP surgery across the UK to screen for cardiovascular disease. And if you're interested in your heart health, please feel free to go to PocDoc.co to find out more. And thank you, as ever, to PocDoc for supporting the show. Thank you also to everyone listening live on UK Health Radio. We love UK Health Radio. We love the fact that it's 24/7 health content and it's the largest talk health radio station in the world. Thank you also if you are listening on demand on any of the podcast channels. We now get downloads from over 50 countries every single month. So thank you so much for showing up and for engaging. And thank you if you're watching this on our YouTube channel, which is at Health Tech Hour, or on my Instagram, which is at Steve Roost. So that's all the show admin out of the way. And on to today's show. So today's show is a big one. We've got a whale of a guest as far as UK health tech goes. So Dr. For those of you, I know we're a broad church, so some of you listening will know what Dr. Doctor is, but for those of you who don't, Dr. Doctor is consistently held up as one of the most successful UK-founded health technology businesses, digital health technology businesses. They've expanded extensively across the NHS. They've really led the industry in what they do, and their founder, Tom Witcher, who is with me today, is consistently held up as a leader within the UK space. So Tom, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, Steve. Nice to see you. You make me blush with an intro.
It's true. I mean, again, you know, particularly in an industry where, you know, we the industry itself is looking for people to sort of follow, and it's not necessarily been the easiest a few years and, you know, constant upheaval. Doctor is a business that everyone, I think, looks up to.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, like all of these things, it's tenacity. We've been doing it for a long time. You know, we actually started in 2012, believe it or not, which scares me immensely, you know, when I was quite a lot younger. And it's kind of time spent with clients, spent with the market, I think, that has built us a reputation, which I have to say I am proud of.
You should be. You really should be. So back in 2012, 2012, I don't need to do that, 2012.
Yes.
I don't need to do 2012, that's different. Back in 2012, what was the world like, and how did you kind of stumble upon doing this? Like, what's the origin story of Doctor?
I mean, sure. So I'm a engineer, right? I'm actually a naval architect by background. So quite an unusual journey to start sort of studying ships and maritime design and all that sort of stuff and end up in health. And it was definitely a non-linear journey, you know, like all the best, right? So study naval architecture. I wanted to be a boat designer. That's what I wanted to do. Turns out that is quite a niche career. Not many people make any money out of it.
Right.
So I ended up working in engineering for a consultancy firm. And that firm was called Newton Europe. They do lots of work in health now. When I joined them, there were about 38 people. Focus majority of like FMCG optimization. So we'd go into a factory, mm-hmm. we'd look at what it made, and we would do a no win, no fee efficiency project. So for example, I met my co-founder Rinesh literally peeling onions for Domino's Pizza.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Right?
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
you went into Domino's.
So it was a factory that supplied Domino's.
Okay.
So a large kind of food processing factory, but they made all of the onions that go on top of a Domino's pizza. Right.
That's so good.
Yeah. Okay. And so we went in and that business was losing money. And we turned it around and it was literally shop floor to boardroom. So walk the lines, look at the onion peeling machines, which by the way is, I mean, it's a hell of a job, right? Whole onions come in, onion rings, onion pieces come out. Anyway.
Wow. How many onions a day, roughly, were they working with?
It was hundreds of tons.
Of onions?
Hundreds of tons of onions.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like one of the biggest food processing plants in the UK.
Wow.
It all comes out, you know, they do lots of different things. But the joy of that work was you'd go in, you'd look at the machinery, you'd look at the shift patterns, you'd look at the people, you'd tweak stuff. And you could measure the impact straight away. Mm. And you'd have your hairnet on. You'd leave the factory floor stinking of, like, you know, veg. Walk into the boardroom and present that you'd improve the efficiency of the thing. Mm. So I was obsessed by this process engineering. That was
your thing.
That was my thing.
Okay.
And
I can tell you, I can still hear the passion.
I love it. Honestly, there's nothing better than improving a process in my eyes, and which makes me a very sad individual.
No. We love that. I love that. That's great.
We did that for all sorts of different things. We did nuclear submarines. We did, you name it. And then Newton won some health work, and I had no interest in healthcare at all. Like, zilch, zero. I thought it was boring. I thought it was slow. But in consultancy, you get sent where you get sent. And I went and did a project in the Midlands. And I won't pretend that I loved it straight away, but I found it fascinating. I found it fascinating how much it was a people and process problem. You couldn't just crank the machine and see the output. You needed to bring people on the journey with you. And literally the first thing I did in a hospital was trying to get nurses on wards to fill out a new form.
Okay.
Right, which is sort of the antithesis of everything we stand for. But I needed to fill out this form, and if they filled out the form, it meant the patients were better coded. If they were better coded, it claimed more income, and it was a net win for everybody.
Right.
Nurses don't want to fill out another form on the wards. It's the last thing they want. And I had two innovations. The first one was print the forms out on orange paper, because everybody remembers the orange form.
Nice. So
instead of, like, you know, you've got to fill out the comorbidities coding form.
Right.
It's the orange form project. And the other one was going to every single nurse handover with a box of roses.
Right.
Those are my two things.
And they work.
And it worked.
Right.
It worked. And we got the form filled out, and it was done with a sense of humor, and we got the coding results, and the project was a success. Mm-hmm. And that sort of got to me. It got to me that, like, these people sat on the wards, are trying to look after patients, and there's people like me asking them to fill out more paperwork.
Yeah.
So that was like interaction one with the NHS.
Okay.
Then I moved on to doing an outpatient improvement project, and did lots of clinic studies, so lots of sitting with doctors, watching what they were doing. And the thing that shocked me was I was there trying to improve this service financially and operationally, and all the patients turning up with bits of paper and having missed their appointments and frustrated or sad or having been told that it had been changed but they hadn't got the updated letter. It was just like... it's a shit customer experience, right? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
So originally, I was hoping that we were going to try and build an EPR, to be honest with you.
Okay.
That was like...
In 2020. Why do I keep saying that? In 2012.
In 2012. So I was like...
What was it look... Because that's a while back.
People
back
were doing then. Stuff on paper in this hospital still, right? So they didn't even have an EPR. And in my head, I was like, why can't there be an EPR that looks like Google that you can just search?
They had computers, right?
They were using computers as well. So you had a physical note. You had... I think they had a homegrown EPR in this organization.
Right.
And then I quickly realized that wasn't... the most interesting part of the puzzle. The most interesting part of the puzzle was, could you reach out to the patient, improve the patient experience, and in the process of doing that, save money and improve the services too?
Mm.
And you have to remember, 2012, almost, it's infectious, right? It's infectious. 2012, the iPhone is 5 years old.
Yeah.
Okay. So the iPhone is a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Apps are a new thing. I get my first iPhone. I had do you remember the 3G?
I do.
The rounded back?
Yep.
I had one of those.
Wow.
Pretty proud of that. And then, you know, it was rubbish in retrospect, but we thought we were...
I think it's a lesson in getting a product out as opposed to trying to perfect it.
It really is, right? Like it was purposefully hamstrung,
yeah.
But it changed everything.
Completely.
And I was sat with this iPhone thinking, oh my God, this is going to change the way things happen. So we, like all the best founding stories, me, Rinesh and Perrin, who are the three founders, I was over a pint. We were like, let's build an app to allow patients to manage their outpatients. So that was the idea. That was the founding genesis.
Just so we're all on the same page, broad church, what is the difference between outpatient and inpatient? Where does outpatient start and stop in this discussion?
So generally speaking, outpatients is you come into the four walls of the hospital to be seen for an hour on the day and you leave again.
Okay.
So it'll be your first appointment where you get an early diagnosis. It'll be the follow-up appointment post-treatment, so post-surgery. All of that sort of face-to-face action happens in outpatients. Mm. And then inpatients will be your ward stays, your surgical interventions. And then you obviously have day cases. So, you know, ophthalmology, they might do the surgery on a day case basis.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of sits between the two.
Okay.
And I'm going to say something ironic for a business that spent 14 years optimizing outpatients. Outpatients should not exist.
You might have to walk me through that one.
Yeah. So outpatients has been around since really healthcare began. There's a stone bench outside Guy's Hospital,
yeah,
which was put there in the 1600s by Thomas Guy, which is the outpatient waiting bench.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Amazing.
You can
I haven't seen that.
You can go and see it.
That's amazing.
They've got a lovely little sort of mini museum outside Counting House at Guy's Hospital. And you can go and see the stone bench and you can see like some of Thomas Guy's sort of statues and stuff. And we've since the 1600s, we've asked patients to sit and wait to see a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
2026, there is no reason that is still the default way of delivering healthcare. The default should be, you're at home, we collect data from you, you tell us how you're doing, we see you virtually if we can, and if you're high priority, we bring you in for an intervention. We don't bring you in for a checkup. That's 1600s thinking, not 2000s.
And how many, how much of outpatients is in this checkup-y bit versus the intervention-y bit?
Yeah, and this is like one of the big questions that everybody talks about. So NHSE have started talking about red, amber and green interventions. So a green outpatient intervention being something which changes the treatment plan.
Okay,
causes an RTT referral to treatment for non-NHS people. Clock stop or, you know, moves the treatment plan forward. And amber being something that kind of was necessary, but maybe we could have done that at home. Maybe we could have done that remotely by text message. And then the reds, of which unfortunately there are far too many, are that I'm just bringing you in to check because I don't have a better method. Or I come to see you about my kidneys and it turns out actually I should have been referred to somewhere else and I get bounced around the system.
Mm.
We think about 40% of outpatient activity is red.
Really?
Yeah. So all of that can be shifted to at home, what we call between appointment care.
Okay.
So that is a mix of remote monitoring, patient self-recorded, so sort of PROMS type technology, and then patient initiated models where you request a follow-up rather than you're brought in for a follow-up.
Right.
So that between appointment care paradigm is what we think most hospitals should be shifting to over the next sort of couple of years.
And what's the spectrum of openness around this concept?
Yeah, it's changing, right? It's changing. So go back to 2012, and I was thrown out of a CIO's office because I said, I'm going to put your patient information online.
What?
Yeah, I was told it's illegal. There's no way you can do that. Don't darken my door.
Information online. What do you mean?
So we were going to front appointments through the internet so people could look at them.
Okay.
And I was told, illegal, you can't.
Well, as in someone can just see what their appointment is online.
Yeah.
Through a portal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that you were told that would be illegal.
Told that would be illegal and I had to leave and don't come back to the hospital.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
You know?
I love those stories.
Exactly.
I've got a few of those myself from a previous life. But
that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were.
And did they have the GDPR stuff has changed over the years.
Yeah.
Were they wrong back then or were they a little bit, they weren't completely wrong, but they sort of.
I think that it was really unclear.
Yeah.
Is the truth. So we used to have N3. I don't know if you remember.
No, I don't remember that.
This is like, you know, a bit nerdy. So apologies to everybody who's listening. But the NHS used to have a network called N3, which was its private intranet.
Yep.
Which patient information could live within. So this is before the days of cloud compute, right? So we had to hire a physical server. We had our own physical server in a physical data center in Reading that was connected by BT to the N3 network in order to get patient data onto our system.
I love this stuff. This is what it used to be like.
Yeah.
And it's, do you know what? 2012 is not that,
it's not that long ago. It's not that long ago.
Like, you think about in 16 years,
yeah,
you had a hardwired box.
A physical box. Physical box you could go and see and touch and, like, you know, plug in and turn off and stuff. So that was the first version.
So the vision was like, wow, we might do one of these boxes for every hospital sort of thing.
Well, at that point, it was really unclear as to how we were going to make data flow. It really was. And you know, we were the first, us and Patients Know Best, were the first two businesses to put data between N3 and the internet and open up that thing. And that was what people were upset about. They thought that was illegal and that wasn't allowed. And, it, you know, 2026, it's national policy that you have to have all your information in the NHS app. So it's pretty cool to see that.
That's
journey.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Like, that's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
It just shows you about the, it always makes me think about how vociferous some of those people can be in that moment. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think, look, why don't you just tone it down a little bit?
Right.
Because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day. I understand you have concerns right now.
Yeah.
But why didn't we, you know...
Why don't we have a conversation about this?
Yeah. Where's the anger?
Yes. Yeah.
Why are you angry?
And anger was a default reaction. You know, it was really interesting. And then the other thing that, you know, I have to say that the information governance community, who still get a lot of... they get a lot of stones thrown at them still.
Yeah. Yeah, shout out to anyone in IG.
Yeah.
You don't have an easy path.
And the journey that group has been on over the last 10 years is incredible.
Amazing.
We have Fiona Caldicott to thank for so much with her principles. You know, and the seventh one being the duty to share is as important as the duty to keep data safe. I've paraphrased that. Apologies any lawyers listening, but the intent is correct. And that was so important that she said that in 2015 or 14 or whenever it was that she wrote the principles, because up to that point, the IG community didn't have any guidance on this.
No, so they were freestyling it.
They were freestyling.
And also, like, freestyling against, if you, the downside of getting it wrong was enormous.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like absolutely cliff edge.
Yeah.
Annihilation.
Total annihilation. And your job as an IG professional was avoid that at all costs.
Yeah.
And we still have it today, right? I still think one of the biggest barriers to innovation in the NHS is the risk-reward sort of ratio. So if it was a balance, it is massively balanced towards do nothing.
Mm.
Because people lose their jobs or get, you know, hauled over the coals for making mistakes.
Mm.
Really, very few people have the successes they've made celebrated. And that's one of the things that I do believe people are trying to change, but it is what holds back so much innovation in trusts today. So thank you, Fiona Caldicott, and thank you so many people that were part of that journey for...
Well, particularly thank you to everyone that gave you guys a shout, like a shot back in the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there must have been some people back in the day that really went out on a limb.
Hugely, hugely.
Like, they took an absolute flyer
with
these guys, with a surfer walking around. right, after this, we've got to stop for our first commercial break. And after that, I want to get into what Dr. Doctor actually does.
Sure.
And particularly... everyone listening is a patient of a healthcare system, lots of people in the UK, what it means to them. And they may have interacted with Dr. Doctor without actually realizing it.
Almost certainly they have.
So we'll be right back after this commercial break with my guest today, Tom Witcher, who is the CEO and co-founder of Dr. Doctor.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome back to the second part of today's show with my guest, Tom Witcher, who is the CEO and co-founder of Dr. Doctor. So, as we said before the break, there's a really high likelihood that listeners, particularly in the UK, have interacted with Dr. Doctor without really realizing it. So from the point at which in 2012 you were walking around plugging in physical server boxes and being thrown out of CIO's offices, at what point did that become a really... What was the evolution, rather, to today where you really are part of the furniture in a good way, in business as usual for so many trusts and so many patients across the UK?
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of today's numbers, so we've done nearly 200 million NHS outpatient appointments on our platform.
That's incredible.
For 37 million unique patients.
Wow.
So it's a big percentage.
That's massive.
In the UK. Yeah.
I mean, what's the adult population of the UK? 50? 40? 50?
I think it's like 65 million people.
Is it for adults? It's still pretty good, though.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so we've had this huge percentage of people have used the platform. Over half of NHS outpatient activity flowed through our platform. We have hundreds of thousands of people that log in and do activities on the platform every single day. A lot of people will have used it. It's often white labeled. You often don't realize it's us, and that's super intentional. It's really cool to have touched that many people's lives.
And what do they use it for? And what does it do? Patients, what are they using it for?
So we have, and I'll talk about where the product's going, but historically, we talked about the platform having three slices. So the core thing that people know us for is patient engagement, right? So when you get a text message or an automated call or use a portal or use the NHS app, that's often us. So we are the single biggest supplier of data into the NHS app.
Cool.
We power the NHS app far more than people realize. The app is not perfect, but I'm a huge fan of it. So when you're doing those things, it's often through our platform.
Okay.
So that's like our sort of fundamental slice, if you like. And if you're a hospital, that delivers you a 5 to 8 times return on investment through better attendance to your clinics, through less paper, through better patient prep, and through all of those kind of like core metrics, if you like. So that's where a lot of our impact comes from.
Okay.
And we measure, we're an impact-driven business, we're a B Corp.
Okay.
And we measure NHS impact is one of our like core things. And I'm really proud to say we've saved over £150 million for the NHS over the, you know, course of the business. So we're super proud of the impact that we have.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of the core product. And we continue to build on that. So for example, we have a new agentic voice tool, which allows patients to ring up the hospital and talk to an AI agent. Now, I'm super interested in AI agents, and we should talk about that later. The thing that makes Dr. Doctor different is if a hospital has spent 3 years configuring its scheduling rules, it means that our AI can actually go and action things. So you can ring up, you can authenticate yourself as Steve, and you can then get a history of your appointments, and you can actually change, you can cancel, and it will adhere to all of the booking rules and the RTT and everything else.
Wow.
So it can actually do stuff. And we think that is the key, right, is giving agents the tools to go and actually do things. So that's sort of the core slice.
Then is that live or becoming live?
That is live.
That's live.
That is live. So we've got one or three big hospital sites that are going live with it at the moment. Super excited by that.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then I think most of our clients are going to end up taking that over the next year or
so. And so just to dub, so I can call up, for example, and I want to change something. About my appointment, and it interacts with me as if it's a customer service agent.
Exactly that.
And it actually has the integrations required to actually change things.
Exactly that.
Exactly. Amazing.
Because I don't know how much we've thought a lot about agentic and things like the voice.
We just went full agentic. Our entire engineering department's now full agentic.
It's incredible, right?
Yeah, we had a company huddle a couple of weeks ago, and I had a proper couple of Matrix moments where I had to like get the dev team to like back it up a bit.
It's unbelievable.
I was like, I can't.
Yeah.
I couldn't get my head around it.
I'm obsessed by it. I mean, as an engineer, I find it just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And I've got Claude Code going in the background all the time.
Yeah, we use Claude Code.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we don't, the core bit around the medical device is not, but anything around, our entire software engineering team is now 100%.
Yeah, amazing.
We think we're probably, we class ourselves as med tech. We're probably the first or the leading med tech business to do that.
Amazing.
Because I think most of them are just, they're just not thinking that way.
Yeah, it's mad.
You can't, I don't see, we're going slightly off topic, but if you have a high dependency in your product around software engineering and you don't go agentic, I don't see how you compete over a 5-year time horizon.
Agreed. It is a huge competitive advantage. Huge competitive advantage.
Yeah. When we were talking, my guys, I don't know about you, but they're talking about a 40x improvement in some of these timelines.
I mean, it's...
You're like, it doesn't make it, it's insane.
I don't know if you've had this experience, but as a CEO, I find it, because it changes your strategy, because you can do so much more.
Yeah.
It completely, and I'm sure you are the same as me in that, you know, the reason we're entrepreneurs is our brains go a million miles an hour and we have ideas coming out of our ears. But the thought that you can actualize so many more of those ideas and sort of broaden what the platform can do.
Yeah.
It's so motivating.
Well, so software development effectively became free.
Yes.
Yeah. Overnight, really. Exactly. Or to the cost of a token or whatever that is. And the cost of getting it wrong is zero. Whereas before, you could have invested 6 months or however much you've invested in a particular roadmap item, and then it gets launched and it's very difficult to kind of throw things at the wall. Things have to... Whereas now, I mean, it's continuous delivery.
Yeah. And if you're not doing continuous delivery, you're behind, which is fascinating.
Well, that's where I am. That's where we've got. I mean, you're either in the hot air balloon or you're not, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
And what's been interesting is talking to our CTO, who's completely led from the front on this in medtech, is how there are some people in software engineering that are pretending this isn't happening.
Yes, which is fascinating, right?
Yeah.
There's absolutely... And within our organization, the people in Not the Doctor are phenomenal. Yeah. But as all organizations, we have a range. Sure. We have a range. And it's like if you spent your whole career as a craftsperson and you're now working in a factory, because that is the analogy, I think it's really hard. It's
brutal.
Yeah, it is brutal.
Absolutely brutal.
So... people are having to adapt and having to change.
So what was the reaction to around the hospitals around this AI agent? Like when you went through it? Because like on the face of it, that doesn't sound like something that they'd be up for, but they clearly were.
Well, so what's so fascinating about AI in the NHS is to our IG story from earlier, a few years ago people were, no.
Hell no.
Not here.
Yeah.
Not doing it, right? And look at the reaction that FDP's had and look at, you know, people pushing back. I think that the cost of delivering care and the pressures on the system have caused people to need to look to different solutions.
Yep.
Is one.
Necessity.
Necessity. And then I think two is it's become ubiquitous everywhere else, right?
So, and actually people in the system are using it every day to do various things anyway.
They're using it all the time. I was speaking to a general manager the other day who uses Claude to do all of his prep. And he was like, this isn't officially sanctioned, but I'm saving so much time. And I have to say, shout out to the NHS managers and GMs, because that job is one of the hardest jobs going. Give these people the tools they need to do their jobs properly. Like, you know, they are amazing, motivated individuals. And so I think people are using it in their personal lives and professionally, sort of in a on the side of the desk kind of way. And everybody realizes they've got to adopt it. And we're actually sort of seeing that as a huge opportunity, right? So we have... half the hospitals in the country integrated with our platform.
Cool.
We have millions of HL7 messages coming in and out of our platform every day with all real-time updates on what's happening with all of these different hospitals. We have high trust with our customers because of our history of delivery. And one of the things we haven't touched on that makes Doctor quite different is because of our consulting background, our delivery team is really strong. So we have a thing called Delivery Partner, and Delivery Partner is how we implement our products.
Yeah.
Their sort of motto is change finds a way, because changing the NHS is really hard.
Yeah, it's like classic customer success.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Imagine customer success like turbocharged.
That's awesome.
And we have doctors, nurses, we have ex-NHS managers, we have all sorts of different people in that team. And what we're finding is trusts are coming to us and saying, look, we know we need to embrace AI. We don't even know where to start, right?
Yeah.
And they're asking us to help. And we're like super excited by that. I think, so I'm not wanting to jump too far ahead, so our stated aim now is for Dr. Doctor to be the agentic operating system for the NHS. That's what we believe we can be, because we have the data, we have the people, we have the trust, and we're building the workflows on it now.
So I think, which is, do you remember back in the day when Babylon, right? And it was all about building an AI doctor.
They were class of 2012. Babylon, Dr. Doctor, Huma, eConsult.
Huma.
There was a few of us that...
So, and then it, because at that point there was this vision around... Because that was obviously way pre-agentic, right?
Yeah.
But it was about like building this AI doctor. Whereas actually now with agentic, I think agentic is much more swallowable because you're building specific things to do specific things that you can build guardrails around that still make everything a 40x, 100x better, whatever it is, without having to go near this concept of like, oh, well, AI means some black box making clinical decisions, which is... That's the about as scary as it gets for the healthcare system.
Exactly. And so we are very much seeing it as, the agentic system. We talk about the system of action. So being the system of action and delivering all of the operational workflows within an organization, we don't need to cross the clinical boundary at the moment. We may. And we've got an amazing partnership with Microsoft. We work really closely with them. Excited to see what Dom King and team are building in terms of some of the specific models they've got.
Is it Copilot just went live?
Copilot just gone live, and look, love my Microsoft colleagues. It's just sat in Word, right? It's not really going to change the world. Well done, guys, but let's think a bit bolder. And that's where we think we come in. Like, we have this deep integration into the EHR. So you can ask, we're calling it DOT, the doctor-doctor interface. So you can ask DOT, you know, give me all my patients on the clinic, give me their comorbidities, we can spit out a list, we can then go and action that. So we can say, fill the empty slots in the clinic with high priority patients based on these.
Did it require you, this is getting quite geeky by the way, everyone listening, but did it require you to do different integrations, or actually you already had the integration and you've just sort of use the different sort of pathway? I'm just curious.
So the answer is there are some new integrations there. So we typically, super nerdy, we have demographics, we have appointments, we have an element of clinical data, but we will only take the data that we need to deliver that specific part of a patient's care journey. So we don't have the full record. We can write back as well. So we, for example, if we collect a patient-recorded outcome, we can write that back to Cerner or Epic or System C or whatever system is needed. And what we're doing now is we're increasing the number of API calls we make. So it does mean expanding our integration surface, but they tend to be integrations we already have.
The thing I really like about this is, up until about 6 minutes ago, I didn't realize this was happening, so this is great.
Yeah, yeah.
But is that those larger systems are so big and monolithic, they are have any ability to do this.
No.
Ever.
No.
But it needs to happen. And I feel like this is the layer. You know, you sit in this perfect position.
Yes.
Where you understand and have already done all of the hard yards and the integration and all of the, everything's required. And you're just in this perfect slot.
Exactly.
Whereas if you relied on Cerner and Epic, and that's just not, I mean, they're not.
Yeah.
They're just not.
I mean, I put a pitch deck together. It's funny, 5 years ago that said, the value capture will happen in what we were calling the patient layer at that point. Had our EPR moment. EPRs are great. They're really necessary. They don't save any money. You know,
NHS England.
Yeah, NHS England put out a load of reports this year showing that EPRs don't save money. They increase clinical safety.
Wait. Back the truck
up
there.
Go.
Well, hold on a minute. Versus what? They don't save money.
So compared to having your previous processes,
okay,
an EPR, it doesn't save money. There is no return on investment. There is
bombshell.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Hence, NHSE has changed all of its funding from frontline digitization to frontline optimization.
Okay.
Because everybody has realized, I'm not saying you don't need an EPR. They are incredibly necessary.
Yeah.
You need a system of record. You need them for clinical safety and audit and billing purposes.
Has to be digital. Yeah.
In no world do I think that we should be doing everything on paper. However, there is zero evidence that they save the NHS any money at all, or they improve clinical outcomes, or they improve patient experience.
That's amazing.
Right. So that's what we're building. We're building the layer that sits on top that does all of those things.
Is that why that they're not, do you reckon that's why they're sort of, I mean, we're jumping around a little bit, but there's this kind of like reference dark shadow around the healthcare system in the guise of Palantir.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you, and I don't want to go in down that road too much, but do you think that that's why NHS England or the Department of Health, they weren't too bothered about picking a local EPR provider for that contract because that's not what they wanted, because the EPR thing really wasn't where the ball game was?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And whatever you think about Palantir, they've got some really cool technology.
Oh, God, yeah.
Right? They've got some amazing technology, and the ability to pull data from the various systems of record, put it together in a dashboard, was during COVID something that no one else could do, right? And that was, you know, we could talk about the FTP story at length and we shouldn't, but you know, that was its scaling moment, really, was that they gave Amanda Pritchard, who was the chief exec, a COVID dashboard. No one else could do it.
Right.
And they
it's a pretty big proof of concept.
Exactly. And they charged £1 for it, and that was really, I think, the inflection moment of the FTP. Mm. And does the NHS need a single data platform? Yeah. I think it's important. Does it have to be on a single supplier's technology? Probably, to do it well. Whether or not they're the right choice, who knows? However, Foundry is still essentially a reporting tool, right? Mm-hmm. It is a tool where you go and you can see what's happening. It isn't an actioning tool.
No.
And that is kind
it's
of
a dashboard.
It's a dashboard, right? It's
a cool dashboard.
Yeah. It's Tableau.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Power BI.
Yeah.
Like, super sexy. But it's in that class of product.
Yeah.
Whereas the world we think that we're moving toward very quickly is a world where you have agentic intelligence, which helps administrators and clinicians and patients to do their jobs and to manage their care. And that's a totally different paradigm.
Well, we'll pick up on that after our last commercial break. This is our last break, and we'll be back again in 2 minutes with the last part of today's show with my guest today, Tom Witcher from Dr. Doctor. We'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the last part of today's Health Tech Hour with my guest, CEO and co-founder of Dr. Doctor, Tom Witcher. So, how fast do you think this train is going around agentic in general?
Yeah, I mean, so fast, right? So we talked earlier about our internal engineering teams. So I had my light bulb moment at Christmas.
Right.
I always do a little project at Christmas, tech project of some sort, and I used Google's anti-gravity editor to write some code. Okay. And I was like, holy, I can do stuff I couldn't do before.
Really?
So that was my light bulb. I was like, wow. And I think if you kind of look at the world, it feels like between November 25 and January 26, there was a light switch moment with Opus and those new models.
Yeah.
Opus 4.6 and the new models. I think that the NHS is just realizing that the opportunity is there. I think it's been fascinating watching the scribes, the Amulet scribes.
Yes. Shout out to Dom Pimenta and Tortoise and all this
stuff.
Huge
shout out to Dom. Yep. Love Dom.
Love Dom.
Fantastic individual, doing it the right way.
Yep.
I think NHS England has had all the right intent with the scribes and with the AVT registry and everything else. I think it has unfortunately made the situation worse and slower.
Oh, how come?
Well, so Penny Dash, who's chair of NHSE, and yep. I don't think we could have a better chair for NHSE. I think Penny is phenomenal. You should get her on the podcast if you can.
Yeah, well, she just came out. She just, we were featured as, PocDoc was featured as one of the four case studies for that annual Health Innovation prospectus last week, which Penny Dash announced at ConFed. So thank you to Penny for that.
Amazing. Congrats.
Yep. So anyway, carry on, sorry.
Penny's awesome. Penny, you know, said last year she wanted the scrubs to be one of the things she achieves.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to cut through the regulation, and I think she has attempted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, a bit of a lesson here, I think, and this is where I begin to sound like an old man.
You've got some scars.
Every time the NHS tries to centrally fund or regulate or legislate for anything, it tends to slow people down, both within the providers and within the supplier industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've done a good job of trying to pull some of the paperwork out of the way.
What were they trying to achieve? What have they actually done?
Well, so I think there was a promise of some money
for
AVT.
I remember hearing about that.
And the problem is, if you promise trusts money, they won't spend their own, right?
Law of unintended consequences.
Law of unintended consequences. So you go, cool, we're going to fund this thing. We think it's fantastic. Everyone goes, fantastic. I'll wait for them.
I ain't buying it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not going to spend my own hard-earned when there's money coming for free. And then the money for free comes with caveats. It ends up like segmenting the market. It comes slower than people expect. Mm. It ends up being capital rather than revenue, and that causes CFOs problems. And every single time I've seen this, and I've probably seen over our 14-year history, I reckon we've seen, it's probably one every 2 years, so let's call it seven attempts to fund innovation, and it always slows things down. So I think we've seen that happen with the AVT registry and the money. I think there's been a lot of noise about a central Microsoft contract that's caused all sorts of problems for the market.
Yeah, that got outed, didn't it?
Yeah,
whenever it was, that got really spicy.
Yeah, it got really spicy.
it got really spicy. I was hearing from some people that some people have made some very, very angry phone calls about that one.
Yeah, rightly so.
Yeah,
you know, I just. And every time this happens, it like slows the innovation down.
So what should they do you think? Let's take AVT or whatever, any of this. What should they be doing?
So my strong view is, as part of the provider contract, NHS Trust should be given a percentage of money to spend on tech and innovation and digitization,
mm-hmm.
with no caveats or rules around it, other than, you know, you can't spend it on BAU services.
Right.
And just let them make the investment decisions. It's like you and me, right? So we both went with Claude Code.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine if the government was saying, but if you choose this thing over here, it's not quite as good, but it's free. Suddenly you have to make less optimal decisions.
Yeah, you're skewing the market.
You're skewing the market.
You're not letting the market decide.
Exactly. And every time that happens, it slows things down. And I think we've seen that with AVT. However, the pull is fantastic.
Yeah.
Clinicians love it. And I think that's like really important, right? Our clinical teams in the NHS are still burnt out from COVID.
Mm-hmm.
There's a stat that somebody shared with me the other day, which is the job that 16-year-olds most want is to be a doctor. Most doctors want to leave the NHS.
Wow.
How can both of those things be true at once?
Yeah, that's quite scary.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah, that's so sad.
So we should do everything we can to help our clinical colleagues with their jobs.
Well, the thing I love about AVT is how the market actually decided that would work.
Mm.
It was basically GPs and frontline clinicians that were like, oh my goodness.
I need this.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
Right? And it kind of massively outpaced integrations with the record and all these type of things. They were using it just because they needed help.
Yeah.
And that's how you know you're onto something.
Exactly.
And then I think, obviously, there has to be regulation in some way.
Yeah.
Somehow. But it doesn't seem like the uptake is speeded up.
No, it hasn't.
As a result, which is weird because we know that the users love it.
Yes, yes.
Right. So
maybe the way to have done it would have been something like, I'm just like making it up, but give every clinician a budget. Be like, everyone gets 500 quid a year or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Choose the thing you want.
Yeah.
And I also strongly think that the best thing that our tech colleagues in NHS England could do would be to stand up a sort of fabric of APIs to create the connectivity.
Oh, right? Amazing.
So be like, cool. Here's we're going to stop trying to build products It's such an error when the NHS England chose to build a product.
Yeah, it's just not their, it's just not their ball game.
It's not what they do well. Instead, be like, cool, here's an API which gives you connectivity into all the clinical systems. I don't mind which scribe you choose. It uses these endpoints, so it can write it all back. Mm-hmm. Here's a budget, and then you just let the market go, rather than trying to intervene. So that's the sort of thing that...
But you could even, and what instead of, you know, I think there are so many people at all levels in the healthcare system that genuinely want to make things better.
100%.
And I have to believe that, because that's what motivates me to deliver and to perform and to provide them with those solutions. I think there are so many instances where programs are spun up and things are happening and funding's found for things that are just really well-meaning, but that don't hit the mark.
Exactly.
You know, compasses and passports and, you know, so much work and effort goes into these things by so many great people trying to really help. Mm. When actually, if you're a tech business, what you're screaming out for is a sandbox environment.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you can be allowed to play to see things in real life. And you can prove to your investors that you've built a bit of kit that actually works, that you know, that's what you need.
You do exactly that, like a Spotify sample.
Just anything that can stimulate, and then you can do hackathons, and you can actually get like loads of really cool, exciting people in a room that actually solve stuff. And, you know, the thing that gets me about the compasses and the passports and things like that is like, you're really just putting on layers of regulation. That's really what it is, which is you've created another thing that I have to fill out.
It becomes busy work, right?
Everyone means well. They do,
but the intent often gets lost. The other thing that I find fascinating is, and it'd be curious to talk to a few other, I don't know if you've experienced this, is as you achieve success in the NHS, you're sort of encouraged, accelerated, and then it becomes a point where you become the enemy.
Mm.
And we're experiencing a bit of that. We're like, you know, our clients love us and we have great relationships with people, but people start to look at you with skepticism.
Okay.
Rather than coming to you with like, okay, cool, you've built a really big business and we're going to, can we leverage it to do more?
Right.
People start thinking, oh, you're going to try and extract value. You're a private partner. We can't trust you.
Wow.
And I find that really, that's one of the things I find most frustrating about our current point in scale.
Wow.
Is I'm like, look, we could help the NHS so much. We are, you know, we are, as I said, we're a B Corp. We've had impact to our course since the very beginning.
Yeah.
We measure our ROI on a monthly basis. Let us into the room. Don't view us as a sort of scare. And I think this is true of lots of other tech businesses as well. You know, we're not here to be managed. We're here to do this together. And it makes me very, it's the thing that probably makes me most frustrated about the NHS in 2026.
And is it, what type of people are the people that think this? Is it like actual trust level customers, or is it a different type of person in the system? Or
I would say it's more, there are certainly some people in trust that feel that way.
But they probably might not be your customers, right?
They might not be our customers. Yeah. And even within an organization, you'll have a range of voices, right?
Yeah.
And our most successful projects are the ones where everyone is like aligned, and the ones where we struggle are where you've got, it's obvious. A lot of it, I think, comes from the center. And again, I don't think it's bad meaning. I don't think people are, I think they're trying to do their jobs, and they're trying to spend public money well, and they're trying to follow procurement rules. But in the process, they shut down the ability to do more. And that is, it's a loss for British innovation, it's a loss for British health tech, and it's a loss for the NHS. And that is the thing I would change the most, is open the doors, stop viewing the supplier community as something to be managed, and you know, view us as partners that want to like make the NHS work together.
So I think this is, I could talk for ages about this. Yeah. So, I don't come from a health background.
Mm.
Like, I didn't build naval ships, but I didn't come from a healthcare background either. And it seemed to me to be counterintuitive that you would not want to extract as much information as wisdom from the suppliers in general.
Totally.
To educate yourself, and you don't need to work with them, but you might be able to learn something. And even if you wanted to like skunk works it yourself, you could probably get a bunch of suppliers in to basically tell you how to do it, and then you could do it yourself. So that's not great behavior. I'm not suggesting that is recommended, but like that would be how I would sort of be thinking.
Yes.
And I believe that one of the areas, because this probably happens to you as well. You get asked in panels or separately, people are like, oh, you know, I'm going to go meet such and such. You know, is there anything that you would change? Or, you mm-hmm. know, what would you change? What would you change? What would you change? And I think the thing, if I could change anything, and I appreciate that the system is massively under-resourced and everyone's extremely stressed and fatigued and in terrible situations. So I totally get that. But I think that there is a lack of ability for or any forum for suppliers to interact with senior level people within the NHS system, senior customers, to understand and to actually scope problems beyond the point at which they say, right, well, I'm going to do a procurement for a widget because I need a widget.
Yeah, by an outcome.
Exactly. Well, way more upstream and actually trying to find a way to bring people into a room to talk about these things, open the kimono, whatever metaphor you want to use. And that is really lacking. And I don't think in any other industry that would be lacking.
No, I agree.
I don't think if you're building nuclear power stations, you're not just doing it off your own bonds. You're bringing in people that understand how to build a reactor. And like, you know.
And then you have the thing of we're all doing this really because we feel purpose, right?
100%.
So we're much more willing to do things for free than in other industries. Yep. Imagine if you got, you know, yourself, Jacob from AccurX, us, Paul from Nerve Center, Dom, in a room together and said, guys, the NHS needs to save $5 billion pounds in the next couple of years. How do we do it?
Yeah.
You'd make so much progress.
Well, you would. And I think that there must be customers, and we know some, and I'm sure there must be people in the system that want to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Partly because it's a fun conversation to have.
It'd be great, wouldn't it?
You know, it's a super cool thing to have. So I completely agree with that. And then I don't know about you, but I think the other area where there's a big gap is I don't really see the senior customer groups within the NHS that have real serious buying power.
Yeah.
Not the centre, because to your point, that they don't really fund business as usual, really.
And nor should they.
No, absolutely, nor should they. Completely, that's not what they're not picking winners. That shouldn't be happening. Those senior level customers are not sitting with the venture capital funds, the major investors, to communicate effectively about what problems the system will pay to solve and what they won't pay to solve.
Yeah.
So I think at the moment, we're in the UK particularly, a lot of VCs have invested in things that they thought would be good that weren't, and things that could have been good haven't received the investment that they should have done.
Yeah.
And I think that's due to asymmetrical information flow.
I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. That's, you know, The NHS really needs a VC fund that's tightly linked with it, right?
And which was what King's Health Partners, King's
Meridian,
HP and Meridian,
And to be honest, they've picked some great winners. So there's something in it. Scale that up, you know. Penny, Jim, that's your opportunity.
Yeah, I think if they could scale KHP, we're a KHP company, so I'm slightly biased. But if they could scale that, I think that would make a lot of sense, and it brings it more into line with the US model.
Yeah, yeah,
where at a regional level, they are prepared to back winners.
Yeah, interesting.
But the thing there is that they've got so much commercial scale that you can actually deliver really meaningful revenues by doing that kind
within
of
a region.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree. I mean, the funding landscape is, I mean, you've probably experienced it, right? The VCs that say we won't fund NHS.
Yeah,
you know, I think that pendulum's come back a bit now recently.
Yeah, I think it has.
But there was a period.
There's been, you know, there's you guys and a few others, and that's what I meant when I said the show. Like, these are the winners, you know, the people that are really winning the market that we need, and we need more, you know, more doctors.
I mean, I certainly think, I hope you do too, that the NHS, the UK, could produce several international unicorn scale businesses.
Yeah, like, it should. It will.
It has
or
the potential,
will. Yeah,
right?
For sure.
But we seem to cut our winners off when they get to, you know, a couple of £100 million valuation, you know, tens of millions of revenue, maybe 50, 60. And then we seem to hit this sort of scaling limit. We don't go, this is amazing. We're going to grow it and export it.
I think it's two things. One is there's no structure, and I wrote about this on LinkedIn the other day, there's no structure that allows NHS customers of any kind to buy British.
Yeah.
Legally.
I saw your post. Yeah, it was great.
Legally, or even sort of, you know, conceptually, like they can't do that. So how on earth can they, like, think about those things? Yeah. So they're, like, constrained, you know? So I think that's, I'd love to try and figure that out. But obviously you don't want to go too far into, like, market manipulation or anything.
No.
But, I don't know. I also think, finally, we should, as an industry, be looking, because there are businesses that make huge amounts of money selling to the NHS.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're just not quote unquote health tech.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm on the NHS England advisory board. There's a guy on it, Danny, and he's the largest supplier of milk in the Southwest. Yeah, he supplies like 5,000 litres a week to every single hospital in the Southwest. Yeah. He's like the king of milk.
Yeah.
Let's go learn from him.
Yeah, yeah? Cool. Like, respect Danny.
It's not agentic, but it's still good. Right, so we're in the last minute of the show, and I asked this of all my guests. On your journey, what has the self-talk that you use, the motto that you go back to that's kind of gotten you through all those tough times that you would share with people that they might get some benefit from?
Stay curious and stay humble. You know, I think the curiosity takes you so far, and hubris and too much arrogance doesn't work in an NHS market. You can be disrupted at any moment. Listen to the people in the organization you're working with. The person who's on the lowest band, who seems to do the most simple job, is where the insight is. Mm. And keep going back to that.
Great. Thank you so much. And thanks to everyone for listening. Oh, if they want to learn about Dr. Doctor, where do they go?
Go to our website, www.drdoctor, which is drdoctor.co.uk. Follow us on LinkedIn. I'm on Substack and Twitter as well. So.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks, Dave.